Once upon a time, Amazon Music met audiobooks, and listeners everywhere rejoiced.
Oh, yeah.
Because now they could listen to one audiobook title a month from an enormous library of popular audiobook titles, including Romantasy, Autobiographies, True Crime, and more. Suddenly, listeners didn't mind sitting in traffic or even missing their flight. Amazon Music Unlimited now includes Audible.
No way.
Download the Amazon Music app now to start listening. Terms apply.
It's hard to read the news these days without asking yourself, how did we get here? Fiasco is a history podcast from the co-creators of Slow Burn. In our first season, Bush v. Gore, we examine an unmistakable turning point in American politics, the 2000 election, which resulted in a high-stakes stalemate ended with one of the most controversial rulings in Supreme Court history. So if you're trying to make sense of the present moment, check out Fiasco, Bush v. Gore. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Do you find yourself impulse buying things you didn't plan to? Whether it's a late night online purchase or little treat for getting through the day, you may have the best of intentions with your money, but keep finding yourself wondering where it all went. We've been there.
We're Jen and Jill from Frugal Friends Podcast, and we recognize impulse spending is inevitable and hard to stop, but that getting to the root of it can make a big difference for our finances, which is why we recorded our latest episode on the top 5 reasons you impulse shop and how to resist.
To figure out what's behind your spending decisions and get tips on what to do instead, listen to episode 466 of Frugal Friends Podcast, 5 Reasons You Impulse Shop and How to Resist, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, and wherever you get your podcasts.
April 29th, 1989 was prom night in the small town of Lakeville, Indiana. And although high school senior Jeff Pelley had been grounded, two of his sisters and his girlfriend believed that his father's resolve had softened, allowing Jeff to attend unfettered. But on the morning after the prom, his father, stepmother, and two stepsisters were found fatally shot in their own home. Then the state ignored the autopsy findings as well as his girlfriend, his sisters, and several other witnesses in order for them to argue that Jeff had killed his family in order to gain access to this teenage rite of passage. This is Wrongful Conviction. You're listening to Wrongful Conviction. You can listen to this and all the Lava for Good podcasts 1 week early and ad-free by subscribing to Lava for Good Plus on Apple Podcasts. Welcome back to Wrongful Conviction, where we have the story of a teenager named Jeff Pelley who was accused of killing his father, his stepmother, and two stepsisters in Lakeville, Indiana, in 1989. Unfortunately, Jeff was not available to record, but this story needs to be told. So to help us do that, we have one of my absolute favorite investigative journalists, Delia D'Ambra, who dedicated an entire season of her hit podcast, Counterclock, to this case. It's going to be linked in the episode description. So Delia, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to it.
And with her, we have Jeff's post-conviction attorney, the president of the Indiana Innocence Project, Fran Watson. Fran, welcome.
Well, thank you for caring.
Yeah, I can't shake this one. So this story requires quite a bit of background. So let's go back and start where it all started in Cape Coral, Florida.
In 1970, Bob Pelley met his first wife, Ava Joy Armstrong. And they got married. And then their first child, Robert Jeffrey Pelley, he's born in 1971. So carries his dad's name, but goes by Jeff. And then they have their daughter, Jackie. They have a large community at the Nazarene Church. And Bob was working for a bank called Landmark Bank as a data analyst. They're living happily in Cape Coral, Florida, which at that time was sort of underdeveloped as compared to the city that it is now. But back then, it was sort of Wild West in terms of real estate development. And I think a lot of people from other states and even other countries saw that as an opportune time to capitalize on Florida's growth.
It's also rumored that there were organized criminal interests in the area, either coming in from Miami or even as far away as Detroit. And Landmark Bank was processing a lot of the land deals being made as Cape Coral developed. Two of the players in the market were a developer from Michigan named Eric Dawson, as well as another Nazarene parishioner named Phil Holly.
The Holly family attended the Nazarene Church in Fort Myers that the Pelly family also attended. The families knew one another and spent time together.
Mr. Holly called Mr. Pelly his best friend.
And yes, Phil Holly had several businesses, construction businesses, a debt collection business, some of which were later alleged to be fraudulent businesses. And Phil had banking interests at Landmark Bank. Also, Bob had done IT work for Phil Holly.
There isn't any doubt that Mr. Pelly knew a lot about Mr. Holly's business. And I don't think there's any doubt that the Hollies were up to criminal activity.
Fast forward to 1985. Joy Pelly had been diagnosed with cancer, and after fighting bravely, she tragically lost her battle. And later on that year, Bob met a widow named Dawn who had three daughters of her own, Jessie, Janelle, and Jolene, and they soon married. And to add to this tumultuous situation, Bob abruptly uprooted this newly blended family from a comfortable life in Cape Coral and moved to a very different situation in Lakeville, Indiana in 1986.
Bob Pelly was incredibly secretive and abrupt about the family's move to Indiana. Jackie, her words were, he showed up in the middle of the night and said there was money missing from the bank. And within either the next day or the day after that, the family was gone from Cape Coral and moved to Lakeville.
Later on, the pastor at Nazarene Church confirmed that Bob was tormented by fraud that he'd uncovered at Landmark. And to add another twist, he didn't pick up another banking or IT job. He actually became a pastor at the Olive Branch United Brethren Church on Osborne Road in Lakeville, Indiana. And the Pellys lived next door in a ranch-style home owned by the church called the Parsonage. The kids had to go to new schools, of course, make all new friends, all while still acclimating to new step-parents and siblings. So, you know, they were in family therapy. And in April 1988, Jeff threatened to commit suicide.
In the spring of 88, when Jeff makes this declaration that he was going to take his own life, Bob gets all the guns out of the home. Thomas Kebb, who is an individual who claimed to have received firearms from Bob Pelly. Bob Pelly came to him and was like, here, take him out of our house.
Meanwhile, back in Cape Coral, the real estate developer from Michigan, Eric Dawson, had gone deep into debt with the Hollies and soon received cash infusions from their business on other development deals. By late 1988, Dawson's body was discovered in a Florida wildlife preserve.
Eric Dawson was shot execution style and then sunk into a makeshift concrete grave in the middle of a cypress clearing. With the Florida conditions the way they are, that concrete sort of broke open and allows, unfortunately, odors of decomposition to escape. And then the wildlife, a lot of wild hogs and boars and snakes came in and began to scavenge. And that ultimately allowed his clothing and things to come out of that and was discovered.
Eric Dawson had been shot with a .22 caliber pistol. Curiously, Bob Pelly had given Thomas Kebb a .22 caliber pistol, which came in and out of his possession around the time of Eric Dawson's murder.
It's back in the home by January of 1989, and then subsequently disappears again before the April 29th, 1989 massacre in the home. So this .22 pistol, why was it going in and out of the home? Where was it? And then when you look at the case in late 1988, it's in Florida with Eric Dawson. He was murdered definitively with a .22.
The Hollies were suspected of that murder, and police found land deeds that Dawson had signed over to the Hollies the day before his disappearance.
If you look at what's happening in Florida the month the Pelly family is killed, that's when they serve the search warrants, and that's where they find clear evidence that ultimately convicts the Hollies of forging those documents. They're never able to charge the Hollies or anyone with the murder of the business partner. But they were able to charge and convict the Hollies of the fraud tied to taking the asset.
Meanwhile, Bob was in Lakeville, and he was very much aware of the danger. This according to a person named Tony Beeler, who was hired to take photographs for a church directory. Bob made her swear on a Bible and explained why he didn't want his picture taken and made public.
He expressed to her, there are people from my past in Florida that will find us and harm us. And he was very resistant to their identities being out there. And then they're all massacred? Like, what?
Curiously, the Pellys were in touch with the Hollies, who knew that they'd moved to Lakeville.
but Bob was certainly afraid of someone. Meanwhile, in Lakeville, the police were investigating a string of petty thefts, and Bob discovered that his son Jeff and his friends, the Herzogs, were involved. So he took away Jeff's Mustang and forbade him from attending the prom or any after-prom activities, including a day trip the next day to Six Flags Great America.
That's definitely part of the story, is that Mr. Pelley had told many people that Jeff was grounded from the prom. And the fact we always cite in response is, well, if Jeff wasn't going to the prom, then how did Jackie know to tell the police he'd be at Great America? This predates cell phones. She'd not been home since Friday night. So if Jeff wasn't going to the prom, how does Jackie think he's at Great America?
So according to those closest to the situation, Jeff's sisters, Jackie and Jessie, and Jeff's girlfriend, Darla, it appears that Bob had softened his resolve as early as Friday, which was the night before the prom. Additionally, the Pelleys had written checks the week prior to cover Jeff's tuxedo and other prom fees. Yet the state still contended that this punishment, along with access to his Mustang, was the motivation for him to commit a quadruple homicide against his own family that happened sometime after 5 p.m. on April 29th, 1989. So let's back up to earlier that day so we can establish the timeline.
He worked at McDonald's that Saturday of the prom, starting at 5 a.m. And then when his father picked him up, the dad stopped at the gun store. Now, the state's theory was the dad stopped at the gun store because he was afraid of his son.
But if you know the context about Florida, this stop makes more sense. According to the store, Bob inquired about a gun for Dawn, but he didn't purchase anything.
Mr. Pelley picked his son up at noon, brought him home. They all had lunch together and watched baseball. People came over to show their prom dresses.
There was a girl named Kim and her date David. A boy named Matt Miller came over at that same time. So they're all there between 4:30 and 5 o'clock, maybe 5 after 5 at the most.
So the state's theory is that after this dear friend and church people leave, he just goes into a rage and kills everyone and then goes to the prom and acts normal.
And according to the dear friend and church people, Jeff had been wearing blue jeans and potentially a pink pinstriped shirt, and the prom goers left around 5 p.m. to pick up Matt Miller's date.
Matt Miller forgets his corsage for his date, so he goes back home, and as Matt is passing back on Osborne Road, headed to go meet Kim and David at his date's house, he passes the parsonage and sees Jeff's Mustang still parked there. This is at right around 5:15. And then there's, I think, one of Jeff's friends that was mushroom hunting in the area. Here's Jeff's car, the noticeable engine, roar down Osborne Road a little after 5:15. And then we have Dennis Nicodemus, who is the clerk at the EMCO gas station, who has an interaction with Jeff, who says it's 5:17 when Jeff is at that gas station.
From then on, Jeff is accounted for, wearing a black Hawaiian shirt and blue jeans, followed by his tuxedo. So according to the state, Jeff committed this quadruple homicide between 5 and 5:16 p.m. But there's the specter of this black pickup truck, which wasn't mentioned by the prom goers, either while they were there as they left or by Matt Miller as he drove by, but rather by a woman named Lois Stansberry, who saw Bob Pelley after the prom goers left and potentially after 5:16 p.m.
She's probably part of the reason Jeff wasn't charged in 89. She was a local, good-standing citizen who said she'd been to Kmart. She came back up the road to visit her father and saw Mr. Pelley talking to someone in a black truck.
Yeah, her purchase at Kmart was documented on her receipt. I want to say like 4:30 to 4:40. And where that Kmart was located, Osborne Road, I think we drove it and it was like maybe 10 or 12 minutes. So based on her movements and that receipt and like one other pit stop she made on the way, she's got to be seeing him, to be generous, a little after 5 to 5:20.
And according to the witness, Mr. Pelley had a shovel in his hand and he looked a bit circumspect. In other words, he wasn't his normal waving self.
When she came forward to law enforcement a week or so after the crime, she provides that receipt to them saying like, hey, here's how I know when I saw Bob from 5 to 5:20. So if Bob's alive standing in his driveway talking to someone in a black pickup truck, he's not getting murdered by his teenage son in the home.
Mysteriously, that receipt later went missing. And the state contends that it must have been earlier and the prom goers just missed it somehow. Now, after this sighting, we aren't sure what happened with the Pellys. At 5:30, Bob was expected at the home of another prom goer, Crystal Easterday, but when he didn't show up, she and her date came over to the parsonage between 5:45 and 6 p.m., and they found the Pellys station wagon in the driveway and the curtains drawn, and there was no response when they knocked on the door.
She made later statements that the doors were locked. In her earliest statements, there's nothing that suggests she tried to determine whether they were locked or not. But that was a strong fact the state used because their claim was that the Pelly family had already been slain inside that home.
Everything that happened after Jeff is accounted for by witnesses, you don't know what's then happening with Bob and Don and the girls. They're either already deceased or they're potentially still at home for whatever reason, didn't fulfill their plans for the night. Were they taken somewhere and then brought back to the home? That's obviously a possibility, a little bit more involved because you would think that someone would have seen that. Were they being held at their home that evening, potentially through the early morning hours?
I think Mr. Pelly got in that black truck myself. If Mr. Pelly's got some inkling this is going on, what if Mr. Pelly left in the black truck and said to the family, prom going's over, lock the house, don't answer the door?
No one saw anyone coming or going for the rest of the night, although there's mention of a limousine with Florida plates nearby. Additionally, the next door neighbor, Sheila Saunders, noted that the Pelly's basement light was on at 9:15 p.m. and 2 a.m. But when Bob didn't show up for Sunday service and the scene was discovered, it was noted that the basement light was off.
So Sunday morning, April 30th, around 9:15, 9:30 in the morning, a man named Dave Hathaway, who's sort of like a elder at the church, realized that Bob wasn't in the sanctuary. His stepdaughters weren't running around anywhere. Don was not there. And so Dave eventually walks over the parsonage, right? He needs a spare keys. Dave walks in through the garage, gets a couple steps in to go let the other elder in. And before he even gets there, he kind of looks over into this hallway that leads into the bedrooms and sees what he recognizes as Bob Pelly's kind of thicker glasses on the carpet, some blood, realizes something is very wrong. And then obviously law enforcement is called.
Dave Hathaway initially mentioned that the blood was still wet, but he later recalled it differently and said that the blood was dry. Now, clarity on that would have been very helpful when establishing the timeline, but let's go back to the scene.
I think the thought always was initially by law enforcement that Bob Pelly died first in the hallway upstairs, and then the killer or killers completed the crime downstairs with Don and the girls, unfortunately with their bodies sort of positioned on or next to one another. And I think that would indicate that they all died at the same time or in very quick succession.
There's also a gunshot in the stairwell heading down into the basement that appears to have been a near miss, which may support that theory of succession. Interestingly, the shooter must have collected the shell casing, so all they found were the spent 20-gauge shotgun slugs and wadding, which is either a paper or plastic part of the bullet between the gunpowder and the slug.
This wadding usually falls or flutters to the floor, and in this case, some of it is in the wounds or on the clothing of the victim, which just goes to show how close in proximity the shooter was to them. There is wadding discovered from two different types of shotgun shell casings by different manufacturers, which begins to open the door of, was there one shooter? Was there two shooters? It just raises a lot of questions.
And establishing the time of death would have gone a long way to answering them. Unfortunately, the coroner lost that information when he refrigerated the bodies before determining it. But there were some interesting findings at autopsy.
We do see popcorn in Bob's stomach. Jackie Pelly always says like her dad's evening snack before he'd have to preach a message the next day, it was popcorn. So it's like, okay, why would he have been eating that in the middle of the afternoon or late afternoon? He didn't really have opportunity to do that because we know he was visiting with parishioners all throughout the afternoon on Saturday, right up until about 4 o'clock. And then all these kids come over to get their pictures taken. So it's like, did they eat those things either right up until they were killed or later that night? But how could they have eaten them if they were already dead? And so it really begins to kind of throw off the timeline.
This episode of Wrongful Conviction is proudly sponsored by Erase PTSD Now. Every day, countless individuals face the invisible wounds of trauma and PTSD. Your support empowers us to provide life-changing treatments like the stellate ganglion block, SGB, which inhibits nerve impulses and helps to restore hope, reclaim lives, and save lives after incarceration. Together, we can ensure that those wrongfully convicted receive the care they need to heal and reintegrate into society. Join us in this mission to erase PTSD and uplift our communities. Visit erasePTSDnow.org. That's erasePTSDnow.org for more information and ways to get involved.
Once upon a time, Amazon Music met audiobooks, and listeners everywhere rejoiced.
Oh, yeah.
Because now they could listen to one audiobook title a month from an enormous library of popular audiobook titles, including romantasy, autobiographies, true crime, and more. Suddenly, listeners didn't mind sitting in traffic or even missing their flight. Amazon Music Unlimited now includes Audible.
No way.
Download the Amazon Music app now to start listening. Terms apply.
In the aftermath of a transformative election like the one we just had, it's hard to read the news without asking yourself every 5 seconds, how did we get here? That's exactly what we're always trying to figure out on Fiasco, a history podcast from the co-creators of Slow Burn. In our first season, Bush v. Gore, we examine an unmistakable turning point in American politics, the 2000 election, which came down to a recount in Florida and ended with one of the most controversial rulings in Supreme Court history. In many ways, it's the beginning of the story we're living through right now. So if you're trying to make sense of the present moment, check out Fiasco, Bush v. Gore, and find out how a statistical tie in the Florida vote count put the nation into an unprecedented holding pattern, during which American voters waited with bated breath to find out whether Al Gore or George W. Bush would be the next president of the United States. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Do you find yourself impulse buying things you didn't plan to? Whether it's a late night online purchase or little treat for getting through the day, you may have the best of intentions with your money, but keep finding yourself wondering where it all went. We've been there.
We're Jen and Jill from Frugal Friends Podcast, and we recognize impulse spending is inevitable and hard to stop, but that getting to the root of it can make a big difference for our finances, which is why we recorded our latest episode on the top 5 reasons you impulse shop and how to resist.
To figure out what's behind your spending decisions and get tips on what to do instead, listen to episode 466 of Frugal Friends Podcast, 5 Reasons You Impulse Shop and How to Resist, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, and wherever you get your podcasts.
When they first began processing the scene, there was an Indiana State trooper who came to the scene and was familiar with Jeff and Bob Pelly because he was in a community club with Bob and had gotten to know Bob. And Bob had opened up to him a little bit about his sort of parental struggles with Jeff and some thefts and people that Bob didn't like that Jeff was hanging out with and bad attitude and things like that. The lamenting of a father of a teenage son. And so the state trooper came into the crime scene investigation with that sort of back history.
Even though the autopsy findings, Lois Stansberry, and Sheila Saunders all suggest that the murders happened later on that night, it appears that tunnel vision had already set in and the state turned him into some sort of master criminal with prowess that would be something out of a spy thriller or something, and jammed a theory of Jeff's guilt between 5 and 5:16 p.m.
Law enforcement and even the prosecution over the years has said, it's tight. It's a tight window. It is a hard sell. We get that. But we believe that he did it because we believe that he pre-planned to do it.
And so they located the surviving Pelly children. Jesse and Jackie were each at their friends' homes, and they said that Jeff was at Great America. So that dispels the state's motive. But then Jackie and Jesse disagreed about whether or not the family's 20-gauge shotgun was in the home.
Jessie, she says that before she left for her sleepover on Friday, that the gun was there, that the gun was on the rack. That's her memory. And she's obviously young. I don't know how often she went in there and like checked, right? So I don't know if that's a memory from a pre-existing entry into her parents' room or not.
But according to both Jackie and Thomas Kebb, that shotgun was not in the parsonage. Next, the local police near Great America picked up Jeff. Lakeville PD went to get Jeff. They searched his car. found a paper grocery bag containing his black Hawaiian shirt and blue jeans, which also had a dollar bill and 34 coins in the pocket. And there was also a legible receipt in the bag. Jeff was then brought back to Lakeville for an interview with the cops in the company of his grandparents.
So 5 a.m. Monday, he waives his rights and he gives a statement. It's recorded. When they ask him, can you think of anyone that would do this? He readily says the truth, which is, the only thing I can think of is it could be the Herzogs. And I'm paraphrasing. My dad was investigating a theft ring. These kids are mad at my dad. You need to go talk to Detective Center.
Who confirmed what Jeff said. Now, without a confession, police began to speculate about Jeff's reaction to the news, which is never convincing evidence of guilt or innocence. But people do it anyway. Now, they also inspected his body for any injuries. And they took pictures.
Those photographs show that Jeff has not a single mark on his chest. So the theory is he took that family 20 gauge and he fired it at least 6 times within the confines of a small hallway and a small basement area without at all one bruise. That's Monday morning. So later, the grandparents agree to bring him back Monday evening for a polygraph. And at this point, they agree they purposely separate him from his grandparents for the purpose of getting him to admit this. And you know what? He didn't confess.
But in between interviews, they discovered something that Jeff hadn't mentioned in his first, that he'd stopped at 2 gas stations on the way to Darla's house. So he explained why, an issue with the car and access to tools that he needed to work on the car. And they said the discrepancy made them doubt his story, that he must have done it, all while the threat of the death penalty loomed large. And importantly, the second interview was not recorded. Just some of his answers were jotted down. And the detective alleged that Jeff said something that sounded incriminating.
They say he says something like, if I tell you what I know, you see, well, I get the death penalty or something. They testify at trial that he said that. Well, maybe that's related to the Herzogs that he came forward with that very morning. He told you about them.
I think that statement on its face is certainly like, what? Who would say that? But you also just have to know where it's coming from and also how people respond to questions they're asked. And if only their response is written down and the context of the question is not included. I mean, I've done this with now multiple wrongful conviction claim cases where it's like, wow, okay, now that I know what was asked, that changes how I see the response.
Without a recording, we don't even know what exactly was said, let alone why. And it also seems that misrepresentations aren't exactly outside the realm of possibilities in this case. And I'm going to get to that later. But for now, we do know that Bob Pelley and the Herzogs were at odds.
People in the beginning in the community thought it was about this thievery Mr. Pelley was trying to shut down. And Jeff thought that too. At the funeral home, one of the Herzogs showed up and people got into a fight. We put on Jackie at the PCR hearing to say the Herzogs came over to our house to threaten Jeff.
And we only raised the Herzogs to give potential context around what was allegedly said in this unrecorded interview. Meanwhile, in addition to the clothing from the paper bag in Jeff's car, the police retrieved clothing from the Pelley's washing machine. According to records they sent to the FBI, there was a pink pinstripe shirt and tube socks with no biological material found, which became sort of a running theme. Like this assailant or group of assailants were like ghosts.
The lack of physical evidence says a lot in this case because it's not just, okay, someone would have had to clean themselves up like from the biological material, but they would have had to get all those shell casings. Be careful not to step in any blood because there's no tracking of blood or footprints or shoe prints or sock prints. There's no smearing on the floor of any sort of transfer like that. So this is someone who is being extremely careful, extremely methodic, picking up shell casings and then able to close curtains and lock doors, get rid of all incriminating evidence, get away from the scene undetected. I think the state, they just kept hitting walls with this physical evidence piece, even down to the point of analyzing the washing machine for blood and biological material. They found nothing. All they found was like a small lit up area where the luminol went kind of wild on the floor right in front of the washer or in the retention of the washer, I think. But right away, the experts say that's probably from the detergent, which like, absolutely.
Picture it. You go to a washing machine after killing four people. You've got it everywhere. You take your clothes off. What happens? It falls where you're disrobing. Where was that? You'd have to clean it up and that would leave a pattern. When they sprayed that luminol, there were no patterns. So nobody wiped anything up.
Also importantly, if Jeff had done this, his blue jeans should have held on to some biological material. But the FBI confirmed that there was no blood on the jeans and that they had not been washed. The police even found a bloody t-shirt in a nearby field that they asked the FBI to try to compare to the clothes found in the paper bag to try to find a connection, but to no avail. And between Thomas Kebb, Lois Stansbury, Sheila Saunders, the autopsy findings, and the lack of a confession, the state couldn't charge Jeff.
Yeah, I mean, in 1989, all the way through the 90s, the initial prosecutor, the subsequent prosecutors who were elected, none of them would bring charges against Jeff because the case, in their eyes, lacked what it would need to have a successful prosecution.
And so life moved on for the surviving Pelley children, for now.
Jackie went to live with her grandparents in Kentucky, came into adulthood and got married. And she's kind of moved all over with her husband and their family. Jesse goes to live with, I believe, her mother's parents, Dawn's family, and then kind of just carried on life.
And remember, Jeff was 15 when they left his friends in Florida, and he had no clue about anything that was going on between Phil and his dad. Plus, he was close with Phil's youngest son, Martin.
Jeff graduated high school. He then moved to Florida in the Fort Myers area. He started working for Phil Hawley. Jeff then married Phil Hawley's sister's daughter, so kind of married into that family. They then kind of moved a little bit here and there. And it was kind of throughout that mid-90s time frame that he seems to have gravitated a little bit away from the Fort Myers area, from the Hawley family with his wife, and done sort of his own thing. 94 is when Phil Hawley and his sons are all on trial for not Eric Dawson's murder, but the fraud that they had committed against Eric Dawson.
Meanwhile, back in Lakeville, one of the assistant prosecutors from 1989, Christopher Toth, ran for St. Joseph's County prosecuting attorney, promising to open a cold case unit. He was elected in November 1998, and they began reinvestigating the Pelley case. But the situation didn't really change until 2002, when the blue jeans from the paper grocery bag with 34 coins, a dollar bill, and a legible receipt were viewed again, but this time in a different light.
When it's picked up again as a cold case, they're looking at old evidence, not timely evidence. And as the court agreed, they clearly confused the blue jeans and make an assumption that the blue jeans were what were in the washing machine having been washed. When that police officer made that assumption, he sent those blue jeans away again for testing. And in 2002, the FBI said they were heavily stained, found no blood on them.
The blue jeans were analyzed by the FBI. They were determined to be dirty. And so those two things are quite conflicting, right? Like either the blue jeans are washed because that's what Jeff wore to kill his family and they're taken after the fact. But if it's established that the jeans weren't in fact washed, had coins in the pocket, and there's a receipt in the bag that they pulled from in evidence storage, then it means that law enforcement can't say he committed the crime and then covered up and washed his clothes.
They never asked themselves how coins in the pocket of a pair of blue jeans would stay there while being washed with a few other items. The coins are very dirty. I can send you pictures. 34 coins stayed in the pocket of a pair of jeans washed? All 34 of them? What are you talking about?
Not to mention that evidence, especially wet physical evidence, typically would never be placed in a paper grocery bag. Now, it's unclear where exactly Detective Whitfield's belief falls on the scale of honest mistake to pure evil. But either way, no one along the way ever questioned the belief, and he obtained an arrest warrant, which was executed at Los Angeles International Airport. Jeff was arriving from a business trip with his wife and Jackie, who then found him a California attorney named Alan Baum to handle the arraignment. After seeing the facts of the case, Alan stayed on board. But even more information came to light after Jeff's arrest.
that's when Tony Beeler, this photographer from way back in the day, who had this weird interaction with Bob Pelly where he made this declaration about his past in Florida and being afraid and whatever he intimated to her.
She comes forward once there's a trial date, and she goes to the police department, not to Mr. Pelly's lawyers, to the police department, and they record her statement. And she describes this encounter with Mr. Pelly in the church, in which he expresses fear for his family's safety from his experiences from Florida following him to Indiana.
Which obviously doesn't really point in Jeff's direction. So that's like not super great for a prosecution.
And that particular tape of Tony Beeler never made it into the jury trial because Mr. Pelly's lawyers never knew of her.
I really don't think, based on what the records show, that it was a reinvestigation to try and solve the homicides. I believe it shows that the reinvestigation was to ultimately clear or not clear Jeff Pelly as a suspect. And those are two very different things. And ultimately, I don't think they pursued really avenues of clearing him. I think they pursued more avenues of arrest.
From 2003, Jeff was held in pretrial detention with no bond until his attorney finally got one set in 2005. And he wasn't tried until 2006.
From 1989 to like 2003 is a huge delay.
That's a very cold case.
Right. I think his attorneys have argued like that in itself could have been prejudicial or was prejudicial. You then have all the way until 06 before you go to trial because of different clocks in the court going at different speeds. And then in that time frame from the arrest to the trial, the state pauses for like over a year to say they need these family counseling records. And that's going to be the thing that, and then they get them and they never use them.
Maybe they were just stalling because the case was so weak. The prosecutor, Frank Schaefer, even admitted to the jury that they had no physical evidence.
There's no blood found on Jeff or his belongings. There's nothing of his found on the victims in a way in which that would indicate he was present for the crime. They don't find the firearm. They don't find the shell casings. They don't find a bundle of clothing in a dumpster somewhere that was somewhere he made a stop. Nothing physical evidence-wise connects Jeff to the crime.
It was a circumstantial case. The investigators described the scene, and then they established their timeline with the prom goers, which was countered by Lois Stansberry, but her Kmart receipt had mysteriously disappeared, just vanished. So the state was able to explain her away, along with other aberrations, like the popcorn in Bob's stomach and the light that was on in the basement at 9:15 p.m. and 2 a.m. So then the stage was set for between 5 and 5:16 p.m.
At that point, the prosecution was relying on individuals that knew Jeff and Bob Pelly to talk about their tumultuous relationship and the issue of a prom. Could he go? Could he not go? Could he take his car? Could he not take his car? And so even though the state doesn't really have to prove motive, they knew that was the only way they were going to be able to convince jurors that Jeff had done it.
The problem with that is Jackie and Jesse both testified that Jeff was allowed to go. But they disagreed about whether the family's 20-gauge shotgun was in the house, which could have been cleared up by Thomas Kebb.
Thomas Kebb never testifies at the trial. Obviously, the defense would have wanted to use him because he's saying, no, there was no guns in the Pelly home. All the guns came to me before the murder, which sort of takes away the state's point of there was a shotgun hanging on a rack in the bedroom and that's what Jeff grabbed and killed his family with. Well, if the gun isn't there, then Jeff can't do the crime. But Thomas Kebb was problematic because I pointed out in the show, if the defense got into why he had the guns, they had to go into the point that Jeff had threatened to take his own life the year before. And I think Jeff's trial attorney saw that as, does that paint Jeff as unstable?
But an unarmed Jeff can't shoot his family, unstable or not. And to make matters worse, that wasn't his team's only failure.
The initial claim in the probable cause affidavit says that the blue jeans were washed. They had 34 coins and a dollar bill and a readable receipt in the pocket. If you go look, which the lawyers failed to do, you find the readable receipts not in the pocket at all. It's in the bottom of the bag. And it's a used Annis grocery store bag. And the jury never heard the word Annis grocery store bag. Never knew the blue jeans were in a grocery store bag. The defense attorneys never looked inside the brown bag to know that the blue jeans themselves were dirty.
He just accepted the prosecution's established fact that the jeans had been washed.
So the state's misrepresentation that the jeans had been pulled from the washing machine went unchallenged, and the jury was left with the impression that Jeff covered his tracks by washing those jeans.
What I found absolutely unbelievable is that Craig Whitfield, the investigator who took up the case, that reinvestigated and ultimately submitted the arrest affidavit and arrested Jeff Pelley, was never called to testify at his trial. So the absence of Craig Whitfield, I think, says a lot as far as how the prosecution potentially saw downfalls of his work.
But it appears that the defense may not have prepared cross-examination anyway.
The evidence was so weak that I think the defense, they weren't as prepared as they needed to be to attack some of the state's points, and totally missed the Florida stuff. Totally missed that at the point that the family's killed is right when the Hawley family's getting arrested.
But it's not like the defense didn't try to raise the specter of Bob's past.
So at trial, the defense is trying to go into the Florida facts without witnesses that have firsthand knowledge. And so the defense attorney says someone saw a limousine with Florida plates. The defense attorney's never found the person who actually saw the limousine. We did. The limousine was actually parked closer to the home from what was in the police report. But again, none of this information was dug out or pinned down by the defense prior to trial.
And without a witness with firsthand knowledge, the Florida facts were denied. Unfortunately, Tony Beeler's video statement appears to have been unavailable as well.
The defense had many copies of all the video interviews the state did. They provided two copies. This one, they never provided any copies. And the defense attorneys both testified at the post-conviction hearing. Had they known about that statement, they would have talked to that witness.
So the jury never heard about the danger from Florida, but the defense did continue down that alternate suspect road, presenting the shotgun wadding evidence, suggesting there may have been multiple shooters.
And if there's more than one shooter, that kind of takes Jeff off the chessboard, right? Because it would just be sort of illogical to think that he had a co-conspirator that's been quiet like all these years. So the difference in the wadding types means two types of ammo were used, but same gauge. So either it's two different shotguns, or one gun is loaded with different types of ammo, but same gauge, which, like, okay, that's not impossible, but it would be odd.
But again, it's not impossible that one shotgun was loaded with the same gauge made by two different manufacturers. So the evidence fell flat without the Florida facts. And then the defense tried to raise doubt about the state's timeline. They put on an expert who had done studies on the rate at which different materials dry and testified that the washcloths, which were alleged to have been used by Jeff at 5 p.m. on the day prior, would have been drier by the time they were collected as evidence.
Unfortunately, that really fell flat for the defense because their expert that they had hired from out of state was just not very thorough with his sort of recreation of figuring out what rate they would have dried at and that sort of thing.
Plus, the expert had conducted his experiments in Arizona, a totally different and obviously much drier climate than Indiana, which made the evidence easy to impeach. The state also played the recorded interrogation in which Jeff did not confess. But then the state put on the stand the detective who had conducted the second unrecorded interview, who testified that Jeff had allegedly said, "If I tell you what I know, will I get the death penalty?" And then the defense didn't raise the context of that response and what it could have meant about the Herzogs. That, along with Tony Beeler, the Florida facts, photos of Jeff's unbruised chest, as well as the truth about the blue jeans, well, they simply were not available to the jury.
And deliberations, and they're saying, hey, we need more on this. We'd like to hear more on this. It's the blue jeans and some curiosity about Florida and Bob Pelley's past, which is super interesting that the jurors at trial are like, well, that seems like there's something there. Can we know more? Can we hear a witness or whatever? And of course, you know, it just that never happens.
Once upon a time, Amazon Music met audiobooks, and listeners everywhere rejoiced.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Because now they could listen to one audiobook title a month from an enormous library of popular audiobook titles, including romanticy, autobiographies, true crime, and more. Suddenly, listeners didn't mind sitting in traffic or even missing their flight. Amazon Music Unlimited now includes Audible.
No way.
Download the Amazon Music app now to start listening. Terms apply.
In the aftermath of a transformative election like the one we just had, it's hard to read the news without asking yourself every 5 seconds, how did we get here? That's exactly what we're always trying to figure out on Fiasco, a history podcast from the co-creators of Slow Burn. In our first season, Bush v. Gore, we examine an unmistakable turning point in American politics, the 2000 election, which came down to a recount in Florida and ended with one of the most controversial rulings in Supreme Court history. In many ways, it's the beginning of the story we're living through right now. So if you're trying to make sense of the present moment, check out Fiasco, Bush v. Gore, and find out how a statistical tie in the Florida vote count put the nation into an unprecedented holding pattern, during which American voters waited with bated breath to find out whether Al Gore or George W. Bush would be the next president of the United States. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Do you find yourself impulse buying things you didn't plan to? Whether it's a late night online purchase or little treat for getting through the day, you may have the best of intentions with your money, but keep finding yourself wondering where it all went. We've been there.
We're Jen and Jill from Frugal Friends Podcast, and we recognize impulse spending is inevitable and hard to stop, but that getting to the root of it can make a big difference for our finances, which is why we recorded our latest episode on the top 5 reasons you impulse shop and how to resist.
To figure out what's behind your spending decisions and get tips on what to do instead, listen to episode 466 of Frugal Friends Podcast, 5 Reasons You Impulse Shop and How to Resist, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, and wherever you get your podcasts.
After she was interviewed as an adult, Jesse, she began to look back on her experiences and memories about Jeff and began to have serious doubts about whether or not someone else committed the crime, and he did. And so by the time she is at trial, you know, she was very convinced that Jeff had committed the crime and that he was trying to continue to get away with it, so to speak. She was pleased by the verdict and there was some closure, but, you know, it was never 100% closure for her because she genuinely just missed her sisters and her mother, and she felt so much had been taken from her. I know for Jackie, she never thought that Jeff did it. She had no reason to think that he did. At his arrest and at his eventual trial, she was 100% supportive of her brother. She thought he did not do this and that he should not have been convicted for it. She was obviously upset with the verdict, but she's also a very determined individual. So really from the moment it was read, it was like, okay, what's next? What's the next phase? What's the next fight? When are we getting back in court?
If you recall, it took about 3 years to take him to trial. Once he was finally arrested, 13 long years after the crime. So his direct appeal attorney argued that a number of issues that caused that delay had violated Jeff's right to a speedy trial, which was then ultimately prejudicial.
The Indiana Court of Appeals reversed the 4 murder convictions and said that there was a speedy trial violation. The state had wasted too much time. And the Indiana Supreme Court put those 4 murder convictions back and said that there was no a speedy trial violation.
So his sentence of 160 years remained.
Then after that decision, I agreed to represent him in the post-conviction action where, for example, you allege ineffective assistance of counsel and constitutional speedy trial violations. Let me say this to you, that no one, not the defense team and not the St. Joseph County prosecutor, according to the evidence, had the FBI file. I got the FBI file because there's no way I believed you could wash a pair of blue jeans sufficient to remove every piece of blood but leave 34 coins in the pocket. There's no way I'm going to believe that. Look at the coins. They're dirty. Look at the jeans. They're dirty. The FBI said they were dirty. So I start from the premise, this is not right. Let me see what's going on.
Fran made it clear that the defense completely neglected to explore how the blue jeans had not been retrieved from the washing machine or how they were falsely represented as evidence of guilt. Then, the defense neglected to show how photographs and a lack of bruising showed that Jeff had not likely fired a 20-gauge shotgun. Plus, there was the failure on the Florida facts.
There were ways he could have gotten it in at trial. Even the judge threw him a bone, so to speak, at times in sidebar conversations like, well, you need to do X, Y, and Z. If you want to get this in this way, you got to do this. You got to give me something to get these facts in that you want to argue about Florida and Bob Pelly and an alternate suspect. That didn't happen. Also, those that knew his attorney and had hired him for Jeff said he's out in California. He's doing his thing. He's not as engaged with the trial. He's doing other trials, like those sorts of allegations. And I think that his attorney has even come forward and said, yeah, could I have done a better job on all fronts? Absolutely. I did what I thought was best at the time. But now that I am being told and shown all these things, I agree. An IAC complaint is completely valid and let's go, which is, I think, kind of rare.
So they filed the post-conviction motion, raising ineffective assistance of counsel and speedy trial violations, and they were granted a hearing in 2022, in which they presented evidence of those claims, along with other evidence supporting his innocence, including Tony Beeler.
So she testified at the post-conviction hearing. That conversation with Mr. Pelly was in the weeks before the family was murdered. And she didn't come forward in 89. She was afraid. And she testified about that conversation with Mr. Pelly. And if you look, the state didn't ask her one cross question. We called a lot of witnesses about the actual Florida facts. We believe that the jury should have heard from the mouths of witnesses, including Detective Kapinski, who believed that the Hollies had murdered their business partner. So we put in lots of evidence about what was going on in Florida that would have caused Mr. Hawley to want to foreclose any witnesses from coming forward. And look, if you're a father and you've involved your sons in a business enterprise that's criminal and you've ratcheted it up to murder, I imagine you'd do a lot to protect your sons.
Laying the groundwork for the danger from Florida and a potential professional hit, they also hired a cold case investigator to take a fresh look at the crime scene evidence.
We presented an expert, Mr. Zappoli. He testified about the lack of proper investigation and how the state's theory wasn't consistent with the forensics. I mean, there's a lot about the crime scene, as our expert witness Zappoli testified, that would cause one to question whether it was the actions of a 17-year-old on his way to the prom.
Or where Mr. Zappoli lands, that this crime was so clean that it likely was a professional hit.
Zappoli says they took big trash bags and they just step in them to take their clothes off. That's how professionals do it. But we tried the case, and then it took the judge well over a year to rule. And the judge ruled on the anniversary of the murders, which felt harsh. Jeff suffers the deaths of his family. He mourns them. So we lost, and now we take an appeal of the denial of state post-conviction relief, which, if we lose, will be a prelude to federal habeas. And our hope is that the courts will see that the constitutional speedy trial rights and the right to the Sixth Amendment effective assistance of counsel were violated.
In the meantime, we'll link ways to reach Jeff's legal team in the episode description. So if anyone has information about this case, please reach out. You just might be the person that could make a difference here. So with that, and with a heavy heart, we're going to go to closing arguments, where I thank you both for helping us tell this harrowing story. And now I'm just going to kick back in my chair and close my eyes and listen to any closing thoughts you may have. We'll start with Delia and then close it out with Fran.
I've really landed, based on what I know and what I've learned, if Jeff Pelly committed this crime, which is a huge if based on what we know now. But even if you look at that scenario, he did not do it in any of the ways that the state and investigators came to conclude that he did. It does not hold up against what we know about the physical evidence and even with some of the circumstantial testimony. And so then you really have to really switch gears and be open to the possibility of, okay, let's take him off the board. Now what do we look at? And in most criminal cases, you would say, here, that's kind of thin, that's hard. But in this case, there are so many credible and legitimate pursuits of investigation that show that other individuals or another individual could have committed this crime.
I would close by saying thanks for your interest. Thanks for the willingness to look at the facts without a bias and with some neutrality. I think this is a case of injustice in which the state pursued the charges against Jeff without evidence that was truthful in terms of the blue jeans and in terms of the allegations, even about the 20 gauge. So I appreciate your audience and their interest. And again, as you said, if there's information out there that would help Jeff, I more than want to know that. The Pelley family cares that people believe in his innocence because that can be sustaining when you have these court battles. And in all of these cases, when we incarcerate the innocent, we let the bad guy go free. Nobody wants that.
Thank you for listening to Wrongful Conviction. You can listen to this and all the Lava for Good podcasts 1 week early and ad-free by subscribing to Lava for Good Plus on Apple Podcasts. I want to thank our production team, Connor Hall and Kathleen Fink, as well as my fellow executive producers, Jeff Kempler, Kevin Wardis, and Jeff Kleiber. The music in this production was supplied by 3-time Oscar-nominated composer, Jay Ralph. Be sure to follow us across all social media platforms at Lava for Good and at Wrongful Conviction. You can also follow me on Instagram at It's Jason Flom. Wrongful Conviction is a production of Lava for Good Podcasts in association with Signal Company No. 1.
We have worked hard to ensure that all facts reported in this show are accurate. The views and opinions expressed by the individuals featured in this show are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of Lava for Good.
It's hard to read the news these days without asking yourself, how did we get here? Fiasco is a history podcast from the co-creators of Slow Burn. In our first season, Bush v. Gore, we examine an unmistakable turning point in American politics, the 2000 election, which resulted in a high-stakes stalemate ended with one of the most controversial rulings in Supreme Court history. So if you're trying to make sense of the present moment, check out Fiasco, Bush v. Gore. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Do you find yourself impulse buying things you didn't plan to? Whether it's a late night online purchase or little treat for getting through the day, you may have the best of intentions with your money, but keep finding yourself wondering where it all went. We've been there.
We're Jen and Jill from Frugal Friends Podcast, and we recognize impulse spending is inevitable and hard to stop, but that getting to the root of it can make a big difference for our finances, which is why we recorded our latest episode on the top 5 reasons you impulse shop and how to resist.
To figure out what's behind your spending decisions and get tips on what to do instead, listen to episode 466 of Frugal Friends Podcast, 5 Reasons You Impulse Shop and How to Resist, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, and wherever you get your podcasts.